Hi, I'm Stan Brakhage, and I want to share with you today the ghost of a great composer, Claude Debussy. At the turn of the century, there was an extraordinary player piano that was invented by Edwin Welt and demonstrated, actually, in 1904. A player piano, of course, wasn't anything new. For a long time, paper rolls were punched in a certain way that when played back, they would cause the keys of the piano to depress and play notes, but in a rather mechanical fashion. But what Mr. Welt had invented was a form of this piano that could be applied to the finest of grand pianos, and a system of quills dipped in mercury that would cause every single vibration of a performance played on that piano to be recorded in squiggly lines so that you could have a playback that was the most extraordinary in its capturing of the sense of playing the piano of anything we had possible until the invention of stereophonic recordings. And one of the composers that was recorded playing his music was Claude Debussy. So you have to get the full magic of this, imagine a stage, red velvet curtains opening, a grand piano sitting in the middle of it, and then suddenly the keys beginning to be depressed as, in fact, the very pianistic spirit as well as the composer spirit of Claude Debussy plays for you his Sunken Cathedral. That recording was released by the Keyboard Immortals series, some record albums, of other composers as well as Debussy, shortly out of print, didn't seem to create much interest in the world, and I don't understand why, because one can really hear how Claude Debussy himself wanted his music played, and in hearing the way he slurs the tones into each other, one can sense his relationship to the French Impressionists, to that same aesthetic that he was a part of. One can also hear that drift as they were making images, wishing to make images out of particles of light. He too, though he was a composer of music, wished to make pictures out of particles of sound, and even in this case to represent an architecture of the imagination. So one hears also in the music how he was a romantic just by the choice of the kind of architecture that he picked. I want to read the first two verses of Edgar Allan Poe's The City and the Sea, a poem very related in its imagery with language, particles of sounds we call words, trying to create an architectural sense of an entire city. Quote, "Lo, death has reared himself a throne in a strange city lying alone far down within the dim west, where the good and the bad and the worst and the best have gone to their eternal rest. Their shrines and palaces and towers, time-eaten towers that tremble not, resemble nothing that is ours. Around by lifting winds forgot resignedly beneath the sky, the melancholy waters lie. No rays from the holy heaven come down on the long nighttime of that town, but light from out the lurid sea streams up the turrets silently, gleams up the pinnacles far and free, up domes, up spires, up kingly halls, up fanes, up Babylon-like walls, up shadowy long-forgotten bowers of sculptured ivy and stone flowers, up many and many a marvelous shrine whose wreathed friezes intertwine the viol, the violet, and the vine." End quote. There's three more verses to that poem, but that gives an idea of representing a whole architectural vision just with language. I mean, there is this yearning in people to escape their own forms of expression, to reach out to others, from which have come some of the most marvelous pieces of art. Goethe, for instance, is saying something similar when he says, "Architecture is frozen music." And this reach from one art to another is the most leavening process of all to each of the arts, and hopefully to everyone's daily experience. How to represent architecture in film? Well, most people would just say you take a picture of some buildings, but that doesn't really do it for us any more than that people are aware, I think, of the architecture around them just by walking through it and using it. I want to play a little bit of one of Peter Kabelke's lectures. Kabelke, who's a Viennese filmmaker, whose films are sometimes shown on the Monday evening series at 8 o'clock at the University of Colorado. His desire, not just to accept that he's a maker of moving pictures, but that he wishes to be inspired by and to actually architect a film, is, I think, beautifully expressed by him in this section.
In your architecture. This is one of my targets also, to achieve architecture in time, clear measures and monumentality in form. These things are difficult to achieve in cinema and I cannot really motivate why I want it, but I mean, this is a very personal statement, but I have had this in all films, to have the films in a way that they can be repeated over and over, and that their form would be equal complex and measured as is music, and so, and that they would give their pleasure more the more you see them and the more you know them. And this I tried to achieve also in the African film. If the film should be documentary in one sense, in one hand. On the other hand, beautiful, formally, so that it could be also seen like a ritual and passed over and over again. And it would reveal only by many, many viewings, things would come up from where you would not have thought them. And when you see this film with 24 attentions per second, when you arrive to do that, you will receive much more than when you just look at it like this. So another wish is to pitch up our capability of time consuming. See? This fantastic beauty of being in a rapid visual construction.
And an architecture is suggested by Peter Kabelke across a space of time. I mean, we ordinarily think of an architecture as a structure that only inhabits space. Only maybe as the Romantics began to appreciate the deterioration of these structures, the castles, the ruins, or even imagine them wavering underneath the sea, did we begin to recognize that these structures exist in time. So there could also be an architecture of time, not just an order, but a beautiful sense of structure of it. Glenn Gould speaks in criticism of his earliest recording of the Goldberg Variations of Bach. In a little section I want to play to you of the last interview before his death this year. And in the course of speaking, he speaks for the structure of the second recording of the Goldberg Variations that was among the very last things he recorded before his death. So that he ended his life as a public recording pianist as he had begun it, for it was indeed the Goldberg Variations that had made him famous the world over at 25. And it was the re-recording of it, however, and his sense of the difference between the two that says that one element that happened across all those years was that he had rid himself of some of the romantic ways of playing that are so become so popular now that Debussy and others began them, and had chosen for a kind of architecturing of time in his second recording. So let's hear what he has to say with it, and in the last recorded interview with one of his dear friends.
Yeah, and quite simply, the trap in this work, in the Goldberg, is to avoid letting it come across as 30 independent pieces, because if one gives each of those movements their head, it can very easily do just that. So I thought that here, in the Goldberg Variations, this system was a necessity, and quite frankly, in the version on this record, I applied it more rigorously than I ever have to any work before.
Well, you mentioned Variation 15, mm-hmm. and of course, it's only one of three variations in the minor key, in G minor.
That's right.
There's another of that trio, number 25, that I'd like to talk about for just a moment.
Mm-hmm.
I guess in many ways it's the most famous, well certainly the longest of all
Absolutely.
The variations.
It's also the most talked about among musicians, I think.
Well, with good reason. I mean, what an extraordinary chromatic texture.
Yeah, I don't think there's been a richer load of enharmonic relationships anyplace between Gesualdo and Wagner.
Well, I remember you used it in your soundtrack for the film Slaughterhouse-Five.
That's right, and to accompany, of all things, the burning of Dresden.
Indeed. Well, I want to play just a few bars of this variation in both versions.
We really have to hear the early one, eh?
Oh, I think we must. The contrast is, shall we say, striking.
That it is.
Now, this is the 1955 version.
Which sounds remarkably like a Chopin nocturne, doesn't it?
No. I think on its own terms, though, Glenn, that this is really lovely playing.
Well, yeah, it's okay, I guess, but there's a lot of piano playing going on there, and I mean that as the most disparaging comment possible. You know, the line is being pulled every which way. There are cute little dynamic dips and tempo shifts, like that one. Things that pass for expressive fervor in your average conservatory, I guess.
Do you really despise this version?
No, I don't despise it. I recognize, you know, it's very well done of its kind. I guess I just don't happen to like its kind very much anymore. And I also recognize, to be fair, that many people will probably prefer this early version. That many people may find the new one rather stark and spare emotionally. But this variation, number 25, represents everything that I mistrust in the early version of the Rupert. It wears its heart in its sleeve. It seems to say, please take note, this is tragedy. You know, it doesn't have the dignity to bear its suffering with a hint of quiet resignation.
And the new version does.
Well, I'm prejudiced, but I think it does, yeah.
Well, we're approaching a cadence, so why don't we use that excuse to switch over to the new version?
I don't think the death of anyone has grieved me more than that of Glenn Gould. I'd come to expect so much of him. Even his eccentricities were terribly encouraging to me all along, just as much as they were irritating to the old style of concert goer. Finally, he had to give up playing the piano in public, I think principally because he had to keep the situation human in a way that wasn't acceptable on the concert stage. architecture or a sense of form as fine as he's talking about it there is usually associated with somebody very cold and abstract and removed from earthly concerns. But Glenn Gould, for instance, really felt at one period that he had to play with his shoes off so that he could feel the vibrations of the sound he was making through the bottoms of his feet, something that maybe Mr. Welt would have understood, who was creating a player piano that could record those slightest variations through quiverings of mercury and quills dipped in them. But also, Glenn Gould needed always, even just as a recording artist after he gave up concert performance, he needed to sing. The studios would try to baffle his out-of-tune and intrusive voice, and never could quite manage to do that. He just finally knew he had to hum or sing as he was playing in order to play his music at the best, and so he did. The composer of the 20th century that is the architect supreme for me is the Viennese composer Joseph Matthias Hauer. And I just play you a section from his Atonal Music, number 12. Every note that goes up must have a series of notes, must have a corresponding scale that goes down to structure it. And I think this is where new architecture in music is heard the clearest. And, as we usual, we end on Charles Ives' The New River.